Well, I have the great privilege to introduce our speaker this morning. My husband, Bob, and I picked up Tommy at the airport on Friday, and I've heard bits and pieces of her story all weekend, and I'm looking very forward to getting all of it tied together this morning. So I just know that it's a terrific story, and she has a lot of groupies here this morning, too. So I'd better get off the stage so we can get her on. And here's Tommy.
Thank you, Mary. My prayer always is, dear Lord, please help me to say whatever I'm going to say from my heart, and please help me make some contribution to this day. There's one good thing about this morning happening. I don't have to think about it anymore. Mary should have been with me all this last year since Susan gave me this privilege, because I thought, oh, I've made some beautiful speeches in the last year here this morning. I hope one of them comes out. Unbelievable. When you took your first drink of your last drunk, wherever you were, I was in Connecticut, did you take that drink with the idea of being here this morning? I sure didn't. I wonder why it is that there are you and I here today, and not maybe 100, 150 other people here. So something very special, some power greater than myself, is going on that got me from there to here. And I wonder if we might just take a few seconds to get in touch with each of our own higher power to express our gratitude. Thank you. Isn't silence great anymore? It used to be so noisy before. I would be remiss if, and I don't know where, oh, there you are. Thank you, Susan. I want to talk to her. I don't care about the rest of you right now. Because it's through Susan and a former sponsor of hers, Betty, who many of you know, and some of you had her as your sponsor, brought me to this point. Of course, God's grace had a little bit to do with it, too, but it's through these people, and Bo or somebody this weekend's talked about people being the vehicle through which the grace of God comes. And Susan, you've been that vehicle. And I want to thank you for the privilege of being here this morning, and to thank you and your committee, because I've been involved with this kind of thing, and I know there's a tremendous amount of work involved in it. So I wonder if we might not give Susan and the committee a hand, let them know how much we appreciate this weekend.
You're welcome.
Great. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. I am an alcoholic. I don't want any adjective in front of that, because I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. I am so deeply grateful from the bottom of my heart for being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is the Mount Group down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, though my original home group was in Cheshire, Connecticut. And my name is Tommy Dayton. Hi. We didn't do that when I first came, so we didn't hold hands. We didn't read how it works. We didn't talk about the steps. But we made a commitment to not drink. We're talking about a fatal, fatal illness. What did I used to be like in a general way? I was the youngest of three daughters. I always say I came from a dysfunctional family, but I'm it. The rest of my family was fine. My dad had the same job for 46 years. My mother was a homebody. church organist. They didn't smoke. They didn't drink. I say it often. I don't think they ever did anything that felt good. I don't know how I got here, but here I am. We talked a lot about time and weather and other people, especially if they weren't there. But nobody ever talked about themselves. Our insides were very private. And I think this is one area in which each of us who are alcoholics, and probably families of alcoholics, can identify. So I don't care what our outsides look like, whether we're tall, short, black, white, skinny, fat, old, young. Feelings are feelings. And this is where I think each of us can identify. What makes me guilty may not make you guilty. What makes you guilty may not make me guilty. But we all know what guilt is. We all know what fear is. We all know what loneliness is. We all know what resentment, and what I call it, self-pity. Self-pity is, I call it Siamese twins because you can't have one without the other. And so forth. And when we talk in feelings, and I truly believe that alcoholism is a feeling illness. I was very active in sports. I was very active in music. In fact, my very first job, I played in an all-girls band, and I saw what alcohol was doing to people. And I wasn't going to let it happen to me. And so I left the music profession, went into the medical arts, and here I am. So what happens to us through a fatal illness that we have is not up to me. So I don't take the responsibility for being an alcoholic. But you better believe I take the responsibility to prevent what I believe is the insanity that precedes the drink. But I didn't know any of this until I came to you. I had my first drink when I was a senior in high school. I'm going to do something. We've done this over from this podium this week. 20 after 12, 10, that means what, 20 after 11? I have about an hour or something. Had my first drink when I was a senior in high school. I didn't take that drink with the idea of becoming an alcoholic any more than I took a first pill ordered by a doctor in 1942 with the idea of becoming a narcotic addict. But what went on in between 21 years and 9 months after my first drink and I came to you is the exact same thing that happened to you. I'm not talking about outside behavior, because I think our behaviors may have been similar, but how we felt about it we can all identify. I do not blame. Blame is no longer part of my vocabulary, but it sure was when I came here. I don't blame my family for my then value system. They did the one thing they knew how. I don't like the expression they did the best they could, but they did the only thing they knew how, because that was the model that they had. I had that first drink when I was a senior in high school, because I thought the young man with whom I was wanted me to have it. Never asked him. But I took that drink for the real purpose of approval. And from then on, till long after I came to you, I did whatever I thought you wanted me to do or be, whether or not I wanted to do it, for the sake of approval. So that my approval came from outside of me. Apparently, I already was not feeling approved of me. I wanted attention in high school, and when I got it, I didn't know what to do with it. I don't know what to do with it today. I want it, but when I get it, I don't know what to do with it. That was only one drink in high school, but it was a glass of guilt. Because I grew up in this family where nice girls don't drink. I grew up in a family that said nice girls. I thought they were saying this. Never heard it said. I don't know where we get our value system. But I heard nice girls don't get angry. Big girls don't cry. Nice girls don't act out sexually. And every time I drank, from then on in, until I came to you, I acted out in any one or all three of those areas very inappropriately. So I've had to learn how to do sober what I got drunk to do, or change my value system. I've had two deliberate drunks in my whole life. I've had hundreds of drunks, but only two deliberates. One was when I was a senior in college. We were going to New York from Connecticut for a hospital excursion. And five of us decided that we would buy a pint to see what it was like to get drunk. Three of them backed out. And you know one of two who didn't, and that was I. And I vowed I'd never get drunk again. Famous last words for us. Just before I came to you, when I was in that paranoia-like stage of my drinking, my husband bought a hearse. And you know what I thought he was going to do with it. Our thinking is very irrational. Excuse me. It's so nice to drink in front of you. We had five children at the time, and he gave me this very logical story. We had a station wagon, and these five children, they were 6, 8, 10, 12, and 14 when I got sober. I was 39 when I got sober. I was 87 in January. They are now 54, 56, 60, and 62. They were that young age at the time, and Charlie used to say, you know, the station wagon, the hearse is 2 feet longer than a station wagon, and so it would give them room to grow. That made a lot of sense. And he said, and besides, if we're out camping some night and we can't find a place to park in a camping area, he said, we could park along the side of the road. He said, you know, nobody's going to bother us. I was thinking about this one. I was saying this one night when I was sharing my story, and it occurred to me, what if we did park along the side of the road and somebody looked in and we all started moving? Well, he drove the station wagon to work the next morning. This was going to be our family car, our only car. And his uncle, with whom he was in business, thought it was a little inappropriate for a doctor to be making house calls in a hearse. You've heard of this as a family illness, right? So the hearse went the next morning. You told me that I had a threefold illness, a physical allergy to alcohol, emotional immaturity, and spiritual bankruptcy. I think I was 39 when I got here, and I was probably about 10 emotionally. And in the progression of my illness, I can tell you just from my outward appearance my story. In the progression of my illness in Cheshire, Connecticut, I did what all mothers in small towns do. I was a Girl Scout leader. I was a hot lunch worker, choir mother, drove the station wagon for the Red Cross, you know, women's club, all that stuff. And I recognize today a lot of it was for approval. Didn't know it then. Everything I know today is in retrospect. And I may change my opinion tomorrow. The only thing that's consistent is my name. And everything else that I say is just what you've shared with me, interpreted through my own thinking. In the progression of my illness, I went from the sober, sane, normal, Girl Scout leader, so forth, to the drinking Girl Scout leader, the drinking motor corps driver, drinking garden club member, to the drunken Girl Scout leader, drunken hot lunch worker. And I'm not proud of any of this, but it's the progression of my illness. And yes, though our outsides become progressively worse, where I truly believe the progression is in our insides. You talk about guilt and remorse. I know you know what I'm talking about. And I don't know about you, but I think we're all pretty much alike. You know, we all say pretty much the same story. We get through the meeting. Nobody remembers anything that anybody said. And they said, boy, isn't that a great meeting. So it tells me that we're talking about something inside of us. Not in the behavior, but inside. Okay. I don't know about you, but I never wanted to be an alcoholic mother, alcoholic wife, alcoholic anything. I remember so much wanting to, when my children came home from school, to have been baking cookies in the house and have them smell that beautiful aroma of cookies baking. And in the progression of my illness, I would have to have a drink to cover up the guilt from last night to get going in the morning. And through that phenomena of craving, I was obliged, once I picked up a drink, to continue to drink. And I never got to the cookies. And I'd come to again, and there was the guilt, and there was the solution, because I couldn't talk about my feelings. And you know the vicious cycle that it is. There's a lot to skip in all these years. I remember saying to my husband once, only once, I am so lonely. And I know you know what I'm talking about. And he said, came back with a very logical answer. I don't know why you're so lonely. You have these five beautiful children. You have a lovely home. You can do just about anything you want to do. I don't know why you're so lonely. You know, that was so logical. But our outsides didn't match our insides. And so I wasn't about to tell him anymore how I felt. Back when, in 1946, my sister was in the process of dying from breast cancer. And I told God, the God I grew up with, and apparently whatever I asked God for growing up, I received. I must have asked within the realm of possibility for my family, because I always got what I wanted. And so when my sister, and I went to church and Sunday school every Sunday for 15 years, not for anything inside, but for the outside recognition. And I told God when my sister was dying, it was okay for her to die in my inimitable style of self-centeredness. And it wasn't until after I came to you that I realized the only reason I wanted her to die was for me to stop hurting. So let's add self-centeredness to my list of feelings and my emotional immaturity. And so I walked away from that God because I didn't get what I wanted. But I found in retrospect that when I told alcohol that I was lonely, it said, have another drink, you'll feel less lonely. And I did, and I did. And so from there on in, I realized today that any time I had a feeling I didn't know what to do with, I drank. And it dulled my inhibitions and allowed me to do and be what my body needed to do and be in violation of any moral value system I had. And that's why I had to learn how to do sober what I got drunk to do, or change my value system. I started to go to psychiatrists, find out what was the matter with Charlie that made me drink. There are a lot of alcoholics in this room, I can tell. See, I told you we were all alike. Our outsides mean nothing. First is seven, by the way. And this was about 2 years before I came to you. I defied him to tell me that I was an alcoholic. And he said, well, let's take a look at your drinking, how much you're drinking. And I said, oh, three or four a day. He thought I was talking about highballs. I was talking about pints. I just didn't mention the word pints. He said, of course you're not an alcoholic, and I loved him for that. Started going to the clergyman, find out what was the matter with God, who wouldn't let me drink but keep me sober. And I went to the medical profession because I wanted to have some horrible, fatal disease. I didn't know I had one. And that didn't work. And why? You told me when I got here I had a physical allergy to alcohol, emotional immaturity, and spiritual bankruptcy. And alcohol had become my power. I can have only one power in my life at one time. I cannot have alcohol and God as I understand him today in my life. And I couldn't believe that I was an alcoholic until I lost faith in alcohol. If somebody asked you today to stop believing in AA, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't know what to do. And I could not believe that I was an alcoholic as long as it was doing something for me. But as my disease progressed, my belief in it became less and less and less. 1960, I was in the Waterbury Hospital for something. They called it malnutrition, for dehydration. I had stopped eating 6 months before and lost 50 pounds. It was the food that made me sick. And there was the denial of this illness. Denial is not lying. It is actually not knowing. We know that. And by the way, it is only my opinion. I'm not giving you these as fact. They're facts for me, but they're not, you know. And I had a spiritual experience in that hospital that led me to believe maybe there's something to this man upstairs thing. Remember, I was still mad at God. I couldn't say the word God when I got here. It hurt my mouth. God. It was awful. Because he didn't do what I wanted him to do. And I was in the hospital with a lady who had been injured in a horseback riding accident. Her horse was hit by a car, and the horse landed on her. She had received fractured ribs and abrasions, and she was to be discharged on a Monday morning. I was discharged on a Saturday morning, the previous Saturday morning. And that afternoon, I had such a need to get back to that hospital. Charlie was on staff at that hospital, and he said, why do you have to get back there? I said, I don't know. What's the matter? I don't know. But it has to be the same bed. Please call the hospital and make sure I get it. He said, what am I going to tell them? I said, I don't know. Got there, and I'm told that we had a nice conversation that night. I had shock treatments after that, so my mind is... I have a good excuse. Shock treatments affect your brain, one's brain, not yours, one's brain for a couple of years before having them. Sometimes the memory comes back. Some of it doesn't, and I'm so grateful and hope that some of the people I was involved with in my hometown were in blackouts when I wasn't. And I knew something was very wrong with this lady. And I called the nurse and I told her that I felt there was something the matter with her. And she examined her and she said, Mrs. Dayton, she's fine. Go back to bed. And I couldn't do that. I am told I called her doctor and I called her husband and they believed me. And they came in. And I don't know, 5-6 hours later, her doctor came to me and he said, Mrs. Dayton, you saved this woman's life. She had had a ruptured spleen and she was bleeding internally. Now I believe, and I kind of believe you believe, it wasn't I who got me back to that hospital. It had to be God's grace as I understand it today. And she happened to be the vehicle. That lady just died a couple of years ago at 94. And I always gave her credit for my life, and she gave me credit for her life. So I stopped drinking for, a couple of months. And we were giving a dinner party one night at Waverly Inn in Cheshire, Connecticut. Now, if you know anything about Cheshire, Connecticut, you've either been drunk at Waverly Inn, kicked out of the academy, or kicked into the reformatory. Well, I couldn't get into the reformatory or the academy because they were both male institutions at the time. But yes, I've been drunk at Waverly Inn. And I thought, now, Tommy, you haven't had a drink in a couple of months. I don't know. You deserve it. Been a good kid. I had grown up so much in those 2 months or so. But I knew from the bottom of my heart that it was the third or fourth drink that got me drunk. So I was just going to have one, and that's all I had. I didn't drink during the cocktail hour, and as my dinner was put in front of me, I ordered one drink, a Manhattan, of course. And it was but one drink because it lasted me until I lost faith in alcohol that November 1960. I ended up at St. Francis Psychiatric Ward in Hartford, where they gave me what they call sleep therapy. It was shock treatment with anesthesia. I was there for 2 weeks, came home, of course with a resentment, because I didn't know what else to do with my feelings. He should have been there having these shock treatments. This was all his fault. And isn't that so real? We truly believe it's somebody else's fault, because I believe of the spiritual nature of alcoholism. And the only spirit I had at that time was alcohol to fix me. And the longer I drank, the less it fixed me. And I came home on a Saturday, drank, drove in a blackout with two of our children, came to 35 miles from home with a car expense written in my handwriting in our car expense book that I had bought a tire, remember nothing, blackout, one after another. Social drinkers don't have blackouts. Called my husband, begged him to take me back to St. Francis in Hartford. 2 more weeks of the shock or sleep therapy, home again, drinking alcohol. It was my solution, except it forsook me the 4th of November, 1960. Thank you, God, I can say today. Because I lost faith in alcohol, because I also had a problem with other drugs, I had a stash of them at home. I had already been banned from my husband's office. He locked his bag, put it in the trunk of the car, locked it in the garage. So I no longer had access, but I had a little stash, of course. What good alcoholic wouldn't? I chose to take my life. And I took an overdose of sleeping capsules that day. Well, the God of my understanding, whom I've come to know through you sharing your God with me, and thank you, saw fit the night that I should choose to take my life, that I should not die. And when I came to the next morning, I heard me cry out loud, my God, I can't, my God, I can't even kill myself. What do I do? What do I do? And you know That's what that one first gift of knowledge came to me. Tommy, you're an alcoholic. That's what this has all been about. Wow. The only thing that ever got me drunk was not people, places, and things. It was the alcohol that I drank. I couldn't believe it. And I couldn't believe it until it forsook me. And alcohol certainly forsook me. Dr. Harry Thiebaud, who was an early non-alcoholic friend, psychiatrist of AA, used to talk about that harsh voice of reality when there's absolutely no belief system. There is such a vacuum of nothing. And there was such a vacuum of nothing that morning. I remember the depth of my despair took me with that loss of self-respect and guilt to making me walk in front of my mother and father drunk one day, saying to myself, so what? And I never want to forget the struggle it took to get me to walk past them. And then it got to the point where it didn't matter. And that's how I was when I came to you. And I don't want to forget those times. I used to go around Cheshire, Connecticut, singing or whistling at the top of my lungs. Wearing the same flannel dirty shirt, same filthy dungarees. My hair was up in pin curls, and some of you may not know what that was. But I had to be ready. I hadn't been invited anywhere for years, but I had to be ready. Aren't we spectacles, though? And I'd go singing or whistling around town so they'd think I was happy, happy, happy. And God, I was miserable. And I know you know what I'm talking about. I don't know about you, but I don't have to worry about where I'm going. I've already been there. And I think each of us has. The morning that I came to believe that I was an alcoholic, November 5th, 1960, a friend came into the house. I was not drunk. I was not sick. I was emotionally paralyzed. I could not move physically. And he said, Tommy, you have to get yourself out of that bed. You're the only one who can do that. And I know you know the struggle I'm talking about. Feelings are so hard to describe, aren't they? But when you've had them, you know exactly what the other person's saying because you identify with the feeling. Try to tell somebody what it's like to be an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't until they are. And then we walk into the room, isn't it wonderful we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous? It is. It is the most important thing that's ever happened to me, that will ever happen to me. So I asked my husband to please call a lady I knew was in the fellowship. And she came. And all I can think of, and I don't particularly like the expression, but many are called and few are chosen. And this gal was sober when I needed her. And she and her hubby, who was also in the fellowship, took me up to High Watch, Connecticut, which it was an AA-only oriented facility in Kent, Connecticut. And I shall be eternally grateful. I'm not going to try to tell you what it means to me. You know what your spot means to you, where you were given that point. You knew you were an alcoholic. You knew you wanted to do something about it. And they took me up to High Watch. Now, that lady had a very difficult time staying sober. I don't like at all the word slipper, because it sounds like somebody did that purposely. We are the ones who should be shocked, in my opinion, that we're not drinking. People pick up a drink if they haven't made a commitment to not drink. And by the way, if there are any of you in this room this morning who is on teetering, should I or shouldn't I, and you know who you are. We're in a safe place here with each other. You won't find a safer place to make a commitment. If you can, for your sake, please make a commitment before you get here. Because our disease promises us that it will get worse. You can look back in your own histories. Is it not worse now than it was then? Whether then was yesterday, 5 years ago, 15 years ago. You're the only one who can make a decision about your illness. Let's take charge of ourselves, our illness. It's the only way we're going to get better. And each of you in this room has given me that gift of knowing that. And I would be remiss if I didn't pass it on to you. That's what this program is all about. That night, I went to sleep at High Watch. I went to sleep without a drink, without a pill. And the next morning, and I ate breakfast the next morning. I went to Wes and I said, how come? I hadn't been asleep in 15 years without the aid of a pill or a drink. He said, you made a decision. And that's why I'm asking you to do this morning if you haven't made that commitment. I will not drink, and for me, a few other things, no matter what, or I will die from my disease. The fourth day that I was there, we only had to be there a week. And there was a picture in our chapel. We had a little chapel room where Wes just sat and chatted with us for 10 minutes. And he ended up with four words, let go and let God. And I believe that morning that I did. There was a picture of a young man in prayer fashion up on the wall. And there was a halo that lit up around his head. And I had a weight on my right shoulder that I truly believe was the physical presence of God as I've come to understand him. And I shall be eternally grateful. I went down to a bridge that was a special spot for those of us who've had the privilege of being there and prayed our Lord's Prayer out loud that morning. And for the first time in my life, rather than my will be done, I started to think about thy will be done. And that was hard because part of my emotional illness, I wanted what I want, emotional immaturity, I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. I wanted to be in charge. I wanted to be in control. I wanted it to be your fault. Failure to me was just being bad and wrong. To me, mistakes aren't failures. There are learning experiences. But when I think of the emotional immaturity with which I came to you, it is absolutely amazing to me. This was all Charlie's fault. Absolutely. And I'll never forget the first time I realized, because I had blamed his hours for my drinking. I was shocked, literally, to find out the only thing that ever got me drunk was the alcohol that I drank. Wow, what a gift that was. I stayed at High Watch for a week. Wes says, time to go home. I didn't want to go home. He was there. And I didn't, for the eighth day, the ninth day, the tenth day, something happened. Don't you love the something happens? We don't know what the something was, but it happened. And I said, okay, I can go home now. And Wes said, now go home and find yourself a group. That was easy. There was only one meeting in my hometown at the time. Find yourself a sponsor. That was easy. There was only one female in my group at the time. I believe strongly in women 12-step women and men 12-step men. Let's face it, we can wrap ourselves right around their little fingers, and let's face it on the other side if they can do the same thing to us. I said, how many meetings should I go to? He said, one more than you need. Should I go every day? Did you drink every day? You folks never answered my questions. Never. So I started the journey of recovery outside of me. I got so busy in AA. I got here to sober up the world, I want you to know. And I'm so sure I'm alone on that. Three months later, this was November, January is my birthday. Something happened. I needed a drink. I don't even remember what happened. And then came Valentine's Day in 1961. I was 5 days off my last drink. Not drunk. I no longer could get drunk. You told me if I drank long enough, it would be like drinking water. So I drank, but the progression was there. And I never, never want to forget the remorse I felt with about 2-3 months of recovery. That was huge. The guilt was huge. And I went up to my then sponsors. It was a Tuesday, Valentine's Day, 1961. And I said to her, Sally, how am I going to have the right change for the paper boy on Saturday? This was in February. How am I going to have the right change for the children, 5 children? It was hard to count out 5 quarters for 5 kids on Sunday morning to get them ready to go to Sunday school. That was a big deal. And I said, how do you cook turkey next Thanksgiving without a drink? How do you Christmas shop without a drink? What sincere questions. And how in God's name am I going to celebrate my first anniversary on Valentine's Day in 1962 without a drink? And she said, could still hear her pounding her fist on her kitchen table. She said, for God's sakes, Tommy, it's only Tuesday. Would you please use it up first? Now, I don't know about you. I was good at living a day at a time, but it was never the right day. So I went home, and I began to understand. 5 days later, we went to a dinner dance in New York. Something happened. Don't you love the something happens? Somebody said something. I don't know. And the thought came to me, Tommy, if you ever drink again, you have nothing or nobody to blame but yourself. And that, I believe, is when I made the surrender. I will not drink and do a few other things, no matter what. Even if all my 5 children were killed at one time, I will not drink. And that's when I began to realize my alcoholism's inside of me. And that's where I have to put this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, inside of me. I don't know about you, but I never got drunk by looking at a bottle of booze. I had to put it in me. My disease is in here somewhere. And that's where I have to experience the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think I work them. That's all up in my head. I have to experience them. Do you remember taking a drink and feeling it going down and then, that's what I had to do with the steps. Absolutely have to do with the steps. And I started to get very active inside of me with this program. Continue to stay active outside, but more importantly, inside of me. And some of the ladies weren't staying sober that I had been given the privilege of sponsoring. Great Messiah arrived when I got here, you know. And I, by that time, had gotten to know Bill. And I went to Bill and I said, you know, these ladies aren't staying sober. How come? I'm telling them what to do. And he said, Tommy, do you think I 12-step Dr. Bob for him to stay sober? And I said, sure, Bill. Because didn't you think that? Didn't you believe what you told them? If they would do it, they'd be just fine to give me credit? It was like chalking up the notches on a gun. How many pigeons do I have that I got sober and I keep sober? And he said, oh, no, Tommy. I trust up Dr. Bob so I wouldn't drink. So he said, in essence, when you think you're so smart, you know what somebody else needs to hear. That's only because your own head needs to hear it. You don't know what somebody else needs to hear. You need to hear your own thinking. So pay attention to what you think somebody else needs to hear, because it's what your own head needs to hear. Wow. So I owe my life to the ladies who have given me the privilege of sponsoring them, because it's when I thought so humbly that I knew what they needed, I am discovering myself. And that, my friends, is why we sponsor. If somebody else happens, and this is my opinion, if somebody else happens to stay sober, it's because their disease is desperate enough and they are willing enough to listen to what I have to say. My saying it doesn't do it. It takes the other person's willingness and my saying it just as much as it says what they're saying and my willingness to listen. And that, to me, is what recovery in AA is all about. When you think about it, and Bill gave so many people credit for being co-founders of AA, I could go down the list. Dr. Bob, Ebby, Dr. Silkworth, Bernard Smith, who was non-alcoholic, Dr. Harry Tebow, non-alcoholic, Silkworth, but every single one of you who has been a power of example, shared that with people. Our preamble says we share our experience, strength, and hope. That's the only thing I have to share. I can't share what I think you need or what you need to do. But I can share my experience, strength, and hope. So that every time we introduce AA to another person, we have become a co-founder. Tremendous responsibility, I believe, because it's keeping me sober. I have a selfish disease, and I have a selfish recovery, and I don't want to miss the chance. And so I started this journey inside of me. And I had a terrible time my first year. It's awful. All that yuck is coming up, all the feelings we tried to drown out, and you can't stop them. And when I finally gave me permission to feel grief, when I finally gave me permission to cry, when I finally gave me permission to laugh, to resent, to hate, to not agree, all those things, I started to get better. Because I truly believe it's resisting what we are feeling that makes us pick up a drink. And if we will give ourselves permission to have that feeling, not hang on to it, that to me would be the shortcoming. I used to hear I can't afford resentments, and I was having them. Well, I wasn't going to tell you about it because I figured I was off the program. I'm not saying it was said, but that's what I thought I heard. What I should have been hearing, if I'd been open-minded enough, I can't afford to hang on to them. And to me, that's the shortcoming, the hanging on. So let's give ourselves permission to be the human beings that we are. We are humans being. I never let me be. And I remember that first year, I had a lovely home. We had, like, talk about making decisions. It was awful. I had five kids, hems to go up, hems to go down, refrigerators clean, stoves to clean, blech, washing, ironing. You told me I had a disease of the attitudes, and I heard somebody say one day, today I'm not behind in my ironing, I'm just ahead in my washing. And I loved it. I began to see what my problem had been. It was a negative attitude. Well, we had this lovely home, and we had like 32, 34 windows, and each window had 12 little panes in it. I couldn't make a decision to wash those windows. And I'd call my then sponsor, and she'd say, wash one pane, dear. Don't you hate those sweet sponsors? And I'd wash one pane. And I'd call her. Now what do I do? You know, wash another pane, dear. That's when I believe we should make decisions for other people. Until we're well enough to start to make them ourselves. Not necessarily always good decisions. Because we learn from our mistakes. And our mistakes are not failures. They become our experience. And that's how I was loved through growing up a little bit. To start to surrender to this illness and give me permission to have my feelings. 19, I had gotten very active in service for two reasons. I encourage you to get active in service, and we've seen so much of it around here this weekend. It's saving my life. And I had eventually been given the privilege of being delegate from Connecticut. In 1965, I went to my very first international. And I love in your program how you have written the I Am Responsible Declaration. It was dedicated, as your program states, at the International Convention in 1965. Now, in those days, we only had one general service office, and it was in New York. And there were five alcoholic ladies who served the whole world. The last I knew, we had 57 GSOs throughout the world with 11 people, AA members, servicing that. But in those days, we had but five and one GSO. And it was before we had the flag ceremonies. The flag ceremonies didn't start until Denver when we had more GSOs. The very next GSO after New York was in Mexico in 1966. And then came London, and I don't know when. And now, as I said, we have at least 57. I don't know if they've established more or not. But before we had the flag ceremony at the internationals, those who had the privilege of being delegates at the time of the international took part in some sort of declaration or ceremony. And in Miami in 70, it was the Unity Declaration. But in 65, it was when we dedicated the I Am Responsible Declaration. I do remember when I started. I can't believe that. And on Saturday night, all of us who were then delegates sat behind the stage. It was an ungodly hot night, and all the bigwigs in AA, Bill and Lois and Marty Mann and all of them, were out front talking. And Bill got hooked up that night. Gosh, he got talking and talking, and we thought, won't he ever shut up? It was hot behind the stage, you know. The one good thing today, we perspire from the heat instead of sweating from the booze, but in those days, you know. So, but then it occurred to us, you're the ones who shut up, because a lot of people have never heard Bill. And let them know Bill. But after all the speaking got done, there was a huge parchment paper world on stage. And each of us walked out through that parchment and formed a line across the stage and in our own language shared the I Am Responsible Declaration. I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. Now, as your program states, that was written by Al S. Al Steckman was one of the first 100 AA members in AA. He was the third editor of the Grapevine. And Bill asked him to write a little blurb about the convention in Toronto. And that's what Al wrote. I have a copy of a letter he wrote, an article he wrote to the West Palm Beach Today, which was the name of their newsletter. And in it, Al writes why he wrote that. And part of his talk, his article talks about our being penny pinchers. When you think about it, we still put a buck in the basket, a lot of us. I don't know about you. A bottle cost me $5 when I was quit drinking. And I was buying 7 bottles a week. If I put in $5 every time I went to a meeting, I'm still only paying what I would have paid for alcohol in those days. I don't know what a drink costs today. But I don't go to 7 meetings a week. I go to 3, 4, 5, and I do put in $5. Because that's what I would have paid. That's amazing to me. We have a financial responsibility to see that this program continues. And because of our seventh tradition, we do not accept outside contributions. If we don't contribute, AA will fail from within. So what is your responsibility? I don't know. I just know what mine is. Okay. 1966, Ebby Thatcher died. Now, Ebby was Bill's sponsor, and as you heard the history of AA, Ebby is the gentleman who brought the message of recovery to Bill and suggesting he find the God of his understanding as he wanted to. And we had Ebby at High Watch. And Ebby was a very gruff man, a very angry man. And he had difficulty staying sober because of the depth of the degree of his illness. And I tried to thank him one day for what he did for us through Bill. And in his gruff voice, he said, "Don't thank me, pass it on." Now, I understand that Bill was the gentleman who was the first to have said, "Pass it on." But to me, Ebby was the first one who said it. When Ebby died, I had already met my second sponsor. And she lived in Connecticut, worked at General Service Office. And we went from Bill and Lois and Hazel, my sponsor, and myself, went from the East Coast to Albany for Ebby's funeral. When you're in the car with your sponsor, things happen. And my fifth step poured out of me that morning. Now, I had done an immoral inventory through many of you. Oh, look, I'm coming apart. My bow came out. Oh, well. I'd give you a little bit of my garbage and you a little bit, you a little bit. But that fourth step says moral inventory. I had no idea what my moral value system was when I came to you. But when we were driving to Ebby's funeral, it came out. My self-centeredness, my inadequacies, my low self-esteem, my need for approval, my self-centeredness, unbelievable. And would you believe there were but 12 of us at Ebby's funeral? All we could think of was 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts. We knew something very special was going on that day. And I remember standing at Ebby's casket with Bill with our arms around each other, and I said, "You know, Bill never stopped 12-step in Ebby, because it was in Bill trying to 12-step Ebby that Bill discovered himself. And he wanted you to know that Ebby died with 2.5 years of sobriety and that Ebby was Bill Wilson's sponsor." And I said to Bill, "Who is to say if Ebby had been given the grace to stay sober that you would have?" He said, "Tommy, I've thought of that so often." Because it was in Bill trying to help Ebby that Bill discovered himself. And that's what it's all about. So pay attention to what you tell somebody else. I'm always so grateful the privilege of sharing, because if I pay attention, I discovered me. And that's what this is all about. On the way home, the third step took me. And it said to me, "Tommy, when you wake up in the morning, the day is already born. Your only responsibility is to see where you fit into the day." I don't know about you. I used to come to and start manipulating the day to make me feel good. I don't have to decide that anymore. It is absolutely awesome to me how this works. Absolutely. What happens is none of my business. How I react to it is my business. I'm still the same person I was when I got here. Show you a little bit about my self-centeredness. back in 1989, one of my daughters who was in California was to have a biopsy, and I already had her dead. I was in Florida. I had a little book with me that I'd been given 4 years before, but it was written by an AA member, and I'm a prude when it comes to my interpretation of the traditions. And I thought somebody was making money on AA, so I wasn't going to read it. And then I remembered that, quote, contempt prior to investigation. And besides, it was a little book. It fit in my pocketbook, so I took it with me, condescendingly. And I'm sitting on the airplane going from Florida to California to support her in this biopsy, if you will. And I read the line, Tommy, get God-centered. And I couldn't believe how self-centered I had been. I was choosing her color of her casket. Who was going to say what? You know, the manager? And all of a sudden, I saw this get God-centered. And I would swing about a half of a second from my God center to my self center, back and forth and back and forth. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, wonder what Barbara's feeling. I was so involved with self that I couldn't even think about her. She did very well. She did have cancer, and she had a mastectomy in 89. And she did very well for 12 years. And then back in 2002, and that was the year our friend Betty died, and my ex-husband died in 2003. 2002, Barbara's cancer came back, and she said, Mom, I want visits, not vigils. Now, mothers want to do vigils. I was in Florida, and she was in California, and I was on that airplane all the time. And at the termination of her life in this era, she said, Mom, I even come for 2 days. I said, okay. So I went out there, and she had already started her transition to another life. And her roommate, and I was getting ready to leave. And her roommate said, aren't you staying? And I said, no. She said, why? I said, because Barbara gave me permission to be here for 2 days. And this is not about me. This is about Barbara. And this is how you have helped me to grow away from the need for a drink. Away from the need for that power of alcohol. And I left. And I went back and got there a half hour after she'd made her transition. And it was all okay. Because I had honored her. Let's honor the people in our lives. Not do what we need to do or want to do. Last May, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it's fascinating to me. Remember the third step that God took me on the way back from Abby's funeral back in 66. You never know where you're going to use this experience, folks. And when I had the mastectomy, of course I got scared. Because part of me rejects. I don't know. And when I got through the fear and recognized what it was, I realized my cancer isn't any of my business. I gave my cancer to God and me to his care. That's what you told me to do. So it's no longer any of my business. When I can get back in the driver's seat and run into all that anxiety and fear again, I'll say, God, please just hold me why I'm having it. And something miraculous happens. It goes. I don't ask God to take my fears away. They're not his fears. They're mine. And you gave me a program to do something about it. And so that's what I do about it. I would have asked alcohol to do it. Why not ask God? The only difference to me is that the power of alcohol forsook me. And I had to find a new kind of a power. And that's what Carl Jung said to Roland Hazard. Spiritum contra spirita. Have to replace one spirit with another kind of a spirit. And in order for us to find that spirit, we have to have a pathway. And the pathway is through these 12 suggested steps of recovery. If we do not, in my opinion, experience the steps inside of us where my illness is, I will not recover from this illness. Step one, tells me about the physical allergy of my illness. Step two tells me about the emotional immaturity. Step three tells me about the spiritual aspect of my illness. So the first three steps describe the symptom of my illness, or the definition of my illness, emotional, physical, emotional, and spiritual bankruptcy. And in the fourth step, I find my symptoms. We've been through that, self-centeredness, all that stuff, need for approval, need to control. In the fifth step, I give those to you, to my sponsor, and to the God of my understanding. And by the way, once I lost my need to define God, I found God. I used to have God as a male image, and I don't anymore. I don't know about you, but I never had to have a special kind of alcohol. I don't have to have a special kind of God. God's God. I don't care how you define him, you know. Step six, I had to get entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. They aren't God's defects, they're mine. My job was to become willing. When I first got sober, willing was about like this. And then it begins to grow. Entirely ready. That step's about me. It says I have to get entirely ready. And then I think because of my willingness, which is God-given, they can be removed for power greater than myself. And the seventh step, all I have to do is get humble enough. I humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. Number eight, the list, I've already made that in the fourth step. And ninth, I make my amends, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ninth step isn't an apology. It's recognizing a symptom of my illness that I need to change if I'm going to survive. And so I go to the person, except when to do so would injure them or others, to let them know my defect. It was all about me and what I'm trying to do about it. Continue to take personal inventory when wrong, promptly admit it. That's easier today. Easier. 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation, improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out, the power to carry the knowledge out. We need a map, M-A-P, meditation and prayer. That's the 12 steps. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry these principles in all our affairs. Or tried to carry these principles. Tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. See, it's a good thing I pay attention to what I'm saying. And practice these principles in all our affairs. The principles are the steps. Some AA member decided to give a name to each step and called them the principles. Those aren't the principles. The 12th step tells me the steps are the principles. And so there's the pathway from the power of alcohol to the power of God as I understand him. And the big book tells me that our real purpose is to be of maximum... Service. To God and others about us. Thank you. See, I need you. Each of us is a chain in the link of sobriety around this world. And I ask myself, what kind of a link am I? If everybody were like me, what kind of AA would we have? It's inventory time. We need to do that. I take my inventory this way. A lot of life has happened. You know, you've heard a lot of tragic things we think are tragic from all of the speakers, and they have just been powerful this weekend, and I thank each of you for participating. But the single thread that runs through, each of us have found a power that allows us to experience those life's journeys with a new kind of a power. And that's what we find in AA. A new kind of a power that we call God or whatever we want to call him. I look at my... Oh my gosh, I'm running over. My 10th step, my inventory. I have these four wonderful adults now. They're 54, 56, 60, and 62. My youngest was six when I got sober, and he asked me a question one day. He said, Tommy, no, Mother, I can't remember the question. And he said, my answer was, well, you know, Chip, it's like which came first, the chicken or the egg. He said, that's ridiculous, Mom. And he ran upstairs and he got his Bible and he opened it where Noah took two of this and two of that on the ark. And he said, doesn't say he took two eggs. That was not the punchline. He said, and besides, Mom, if the egg came first, who'd sit on him? My oldest daughter lost two children. My second child, 60, lost a daughter. My third daughter, Barbara, her husband was killed 6 weeks after she was married. And then she had the cancer and she died with 12 years of recovery. Susan's husband, my fourth daughter, was killed by a drunken driver when she was a month pregnant with her second child. My son, Chip, 54, has 34 years, April 1st, in the fellowship. Not in the fellowship, but not drinking. Beautiful, spiritual young man. He's just retired from the post office. So I have these five beautiful children. Charlie chose to live his life with another family, so I'm no longer married. My parents died. Life happens to us. But we discover new power that allows us to experience real feelings appropriate for the occasion. My sponsor died in my arms in 71. Sponsors teach us how to live. That lady taught me how to die. And it goes on and on and on. It really does. Through God's grace, I have many friends, so I'm a friend. And I ask me these questions. Am I the kind of mother I would like to have? What kind of an AA member am I? Grandmother, great-grandmother, I got 9 great-grandkids. They keep coming. I'm going to keep coming. What kind of an AA member am I? Am I the kind of friend I would like to have? And when the answer comes back, no, it's time for me to look within me to see where I am just bordering off the program, back to my self-centeredness. And I need to do that in order to let the God's grace within work without. You have a quote in your program of the last sentence on page 164, and it talks about trudging the road of happy destiny. Not to happy destiny, of happy destiny. I looked up the definition of trudge, and it says walk with a purpose. We've had such a remarkable experience this weekend. When we leave here, let's walk with a purpose. Let's be available for the next person who needs our help, because it isn't trying to give it away that we keep it. I'd like to close with two examples of 12-step work we used to do. We had a gal in Connecticut who was going from New Haven to Chicago many years ago by bus, scared to death. We got a bus schedule and we got a world directory, and at every single bus stop from New Haven to Chicago was an AA arm with a cup of coffee welcoming that lady off the bus. That's 12-step work as we used to do it. My last visit with Bill and Lois, and they were dear friends, but the last one was of my personal time with Bill. Lois had invited us to lunch, and it was a snowy day in February of 1969. 70, I think. Anyhow, 70. And if you've never been to Stepping Stones, or you have, you walk in the living room and there's a fireplace on the left. Bill had a roaring fire. It was beautiful. Then the living room that had a coffee table and a couch looking into the fireplace. And over in your right-hand corner was their kitchen dining room table. And we were having lunch and Lois was on one end, then my sponsor, Hazel, then myself, and then Bill on this corner, and a lady who should remain nameless. And she was having a difficult time with depression. And she excused herself and got up and went over and laid down on the couch. Bill loved the crowds, but he loved more being with an alcoholic who was in pain. And I don't think a minute went by that Bill excused himself from the table and got up and went over and sat down on the coffee table so that he was facing us, looking down on her. We couldn't see her, but we watched Bill Wilson do a 12-step call. The privileges I had are innumerable. Why me, God? No more question mark. Exclamation. It's yours for the asking. All we have to do is make the commitment. I would like to close a little prayer. I pray very often. But may I say first, thank you, Susan, and your committee. I believe the key to my sobriety are two words, I believe, and people. And to me, people are like the seeds of a flower. They need the miracle of God and man to make them grow. And to me, that is AA, the miracle of God and man. Dear Lord, please help me to accept the kind of life you have chosen for me to live. Make me ever mindful of the needs of others and what you would have me do with my life, that thy will be done. Thank you very much, and I love you.